Hi, this is Maria Olson. You may know me from Trophy Heads or Starry Eyes and maybe Paranormal Activity 3. And I want to welcome you to Anthony T's Horror Show because it's an awesome show.
Hi, my name is Jessica Cameron and you're listening to Anthony T's Horror Show.
Hey, fellow horror fans. This is Troy Escamilla, the director of Party Night and Mrs. Claus. And you are listening to Anthony T's Horror Show. Enjoy.
Welcome to an edition of Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm Anthony T. This edition, I will be talking with author Patrick Rahal, who you might know as Patsy the Angry Nerd from Throwdown Thursday. He has a new book out called How Much Do You Tip an Exorcist? He will be on to talk about his new book. Alongside that, the most talked about topic on my podcast, Jason Blum! And Blumhouse Pictures recently released a trailer for the upcoming film The Craft Legacy, which I have some thoughts about, and I really need to get that off my chest, because I hate to say this, it's like I have to scold Jason Blum again. I did this late last year with Black Christmas, and I'm going to do the same with this trailer for The Craft Legacy, because this pretty much to me ruins the classic film, which I'll also talk about in What's Anthony T Watching. But first, the news. According to BladeDisgusting.com, Nightbreed is coming in form of a TV series. It's the second Clive Barker property to be announced for a TV series. Nightbreed is based on Clive Barker's novella Cabal. He also wrote and directed the 1990 feature film called Nightbreed. This is interesting because I never heard of rumors of a Nightbreed TV series until now. Also, there's a big genre name attached to it, as Trick or Treat Michael Dougherty will be directing the series adaptation of Nightbreed. Now, this is surprising, seriously, because he's also working on HBO's Hellraiser series. It's like we're not getting one Clive Barker adaptation, but two Clive Barker adaptations from director Michael Dougherty. This is going to be an interesting one. I have to admit, I loved the 1990 Clive Barker film, and I really think a TV series may be able to flesh out more of what Nightbreed is supposed to be, because originally this film was heavily cut when it first came out back in 1990. But thankfully, we will be getting quite possibly the true definitive version of Nightbreed. Yes, we had the Cabal cut that was released by Scream Factory. Next year is probably going to be an interesting year related to Clive Barker material. First, you still have the Candyman reboot, in which Clive Barker directed the original and wrote the book for Candyman. You have the Hellraiser TV series that supposedly is in the works. And now you got a Nightbreed TV series to top that off. There's a lot of Clive Barker adaptations going on right now. And oh, I forgot to mention, Clive Barker's Books of Blood is already on Hulu. So there's a lot of Clive Barker adaptations coming out, starting right now with the Books of Blood. So it's going to be a very interesting to see how all those turn out. As I am a fan of the films of Clive Barker, I think he's a very good director. I wished he continued directing films, because Nightbreed was excellent and Hellraiser was excellent. I really wish he continued to direct films alongside writing his novels, because he's very accomplished at both. Starting now, it's a very interesting time if you're a fan of Clive Barker, because I really cannot wait to check out Books of Blood, currently streaming on Hulu, and all the other projects on the horizon based on Clive Barker adaptations. And finally, in news, unlike the trailer that I'm about ready to talk about next segment, this is a film I actually want to see. Warner Brothers recently announced that the remake of The Witches is coming to HBO Max. That means the remake of the Roger Dahl book in which the film is based on is coming to HBO Max on October 22nd. The film stars Anne Hathaway, Octavia Spencer, and Stanley Tucci. This is a film that is co-written and produced by Guillermo del Toro and directed by Robert Zemeckis. This is something I wanted to see for a while because, first of all, I'm a Guillermo del Toro fan. Second of all, I loved The Witches when it came out in 1990 as I was a kid back then, with Angelica Houston as the villain in that original film. This film looks like it's going to be much darker than the original film, but it's Guillermo del Toro producing and co-writing the screenplay, so I do have a lot of confidence in this film. It looks very good from the trailer, unlike the trailer I'm going to talk about next segment, and it's something that I'm happy to say I can see for the very low price of $0. That's right, I don't have to pay a dime to see this film, because yours truly has an HBO Max subscription via cable, so I can get HBO Max for nothing, so I can't wait to watch it on my Xbox. Sorry Roku, sorry Amazon Fire, HBO Max is not on any of those platforms at this time to my knowledge, so it's either watching it on a tablet or having a gaming console to watch the film on TV. If there was one drawback to this remake, it's the fact that Rowan Atkinson isn't in the film. He was in the original film as Mr. Stringer, and for those people who don't know who Rowan Atkinson is, he played probably the most funniest character in the history of television with Mr. Bean. I always loved watching those episodes. Those were hilarious. And he was very good in The Witches. It's literally going to be hard to watch that film and not see Rowan Atkinson in it, because I love the guy. I think he's a very funny comedian. And he played his character in the original film very well. So, it's going to be missing Rowan Atkinson. And probably some of the humor, too, that the original film had. But I can't wait to watch The Witches as that hits HBO Max October 22nd. And with that, that's the news.
To Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. A weekly podcast where the discussion is about the most recent horror and genre films. Intelligent talk on a genre that deserves intelligence. A conversation between co-hosts discussing not only the film, but also the connotation that the directors and screenwriters are trying to articulate. When you want more than a review, listen to Dark Discussions.
And speaking of perception, there's just one more scene I want to talk about, which is after Caleb discovers that Kyoto's a robot, Kyoto kind of peels off her skin, showing him what's underneath.
Now, wait a minute. I know where you're going with this, but tell me you weren't already thinking this 15 minutes earlier in the film. Exactly what he's thinking at that moment.
Which is he's a robot, too.
Oh, I considered the possibility.
Right, and that's what I like, is the fact that the writers were smart enough to know that this is what the audience would be thinking.
We've all seen Blade Runner.
Right. Exactly.
www.darkdiscussions.com, wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome back. I was going to originally this episode talk about Wild Eye releasing, because I have a major gripe with Wild Eye releasing. I won't tell you what it is now, but you will be hearing about that major gripe very soon, because I can't talk about it now, since the most talked about topic on the podcast made news for something really bad. I think you know, if you're a long-time listener, what I'm about ready to say, as it's time to talk about Jason Blum and Blumhouse Pictures. Because recently, I saw the trailer for the upcoming The Craft Legacy, which is supposedly coming out on VOD this month. I can't tell if this film is a sequel to The Craft, a reboot of The Craft, a remake of The Craft, or all three of them. Because this is a film which really, I think, spits in the face of the original film. As this film slash sequel slash reboot slash remake feels like it doesn't take the original too seriously. Yes, you see a picture of one of the characters in the original film, but to me, the look looks like it's totally different from the original The Craft. Now, in 1996, when the film was first released, this film really had a gothic tone to it. It really, into the way each of the characters looked. This film also is a film that you could literally buy the fact that these characters are outcasts. You can buy the fact that these characters aren't the popular kids in the room. The trailer for the sequel, The Craft Legacy, I don't buy any of that. Seriously, they don't look like outcasts. They don't look like the characters from the original film. I cannot buy the fact that these four characters are outcasts. I have a hard time trying to buy that. So that's one of the reasons why I'm not thrilled with this film. The second, the trailer looked bad. The trailer looked like it was something that you would see on the CW network. It wasn't something that you would see on a big screen. And it infuriates me that this film doesn't look like it's going to honor the original. And that really saddens me, because I really loved The Craft. But the most egregious thing that I saw in the trailer was the fact that one of the characters utters the original film's most trademark line, "We are the weirdos, mister." Hello? I don't buy the fact that these characters are the weirdos. I just don't buy that fact. In the original, you could buy that fact because a couple of them dressed kind of goth-looking. That helped make the line effective. In this film, it does not make the line effective, in my opinion. Seriously. Why does Jason Blum want to ruin every horror film ever made? Because I'm starting to get that impression. He's ruined Black Christmas already with that horrible trailer. I will not see that film within 10 miles. I will stay far away from that film. And now this trailer, which looks like something you would see on the CW network. And this is not what the original Craft is about. It's supposed to be dark. The next thing I'm probably going to find out that this film is probably going to be rated PG-13. As I can really get the vibes that this is going to be a PG-13 film. Seriously. This film did not scream rated R to me. This film screamed PG-13. Look what happened the last time Jason Blum and Blumhouse Pictures remade a horror classic into a PG-13 film. Black Christmas failed miserably at the box office during the Christmas season. What I'm trying to say is, I don't get what Jason Blum is doing. Is he trying to appeal to young moviegoers? Because it's certainly not appealing to the horror film fan, as we want to see edgy R-rated content. Not PG-13 films, like this film looks like it's going to be a PG-13. Edgy content. We don't want to see our classics being dumbed down to PG-13/CW network type of films. And it's getting to the point where I'm starting to feel that. Unless you're David Gordon Green, Jordan Peele, or Leigh Whannell, every horror remake that Blumhouse Pictures has put out is PG-13. They've done that with Fantasy Island. They've done that with Black Christmas. And it looks like they're doing it with The Craft Legacy. So do not be surprised if this film is PG-13. Because this film looks like, to me, a PG-13 film. And the most egregious thing besides that is Michelle Moynihan and David Duchovny are in this film. It's like two good actors is in this film? In this film that looks like garbage? What is going on with their careers? Seriously, nobody hiring them? Because they're good actors. They're serviceable actors. But they're being put into a film where they're probably going to do nothing. They just serve as a backdrop to one of the characters. And that's it. Why aren't those two actors getting better material? Instead, they're trapped in this Jason Blum piece of trash. Really, I've lost all faith in wanting to see The Craft Legacy. I was very skeptical, but I had an open mind when I first heard news of this film coming out. Now, after seeing this trailer, I don't want to see this film. This film looks like it's going to be another Blumhouse failure. Why don't you guys release Halloween Kills? Or why don't you guys release Candyman? Or get Universal Pictures to release them on VOD. Your upcoming film after The Craft, Jason Blum, Freaky, is probably going to head to VOD. Because theaters are going to close completely. And it's ridiculous that the horror films that we want to see from Blumhouse Pictures are being held up by the studios in some wishful thinking theaters will be coming back. It's going to take months before theaters come back to normal. It may be another year before theaters go back to normal. So why not release those films instead of going and releasing crap like The Craft Legacy, Jason Blum? Seriously, Jason Blum. You have pull in Hollywood. We want to see your major releases. Because I'm going to tell you something. The reason why I think Sony Pictures is really releasing The Craft Legacy on VOD is because they figure this film sucks. And why not just dump it on VOD now, make your money that way, instead of putting it in theaters once they're back at full strength. Because it will not survive in theaters at a normal box office season. Come on, Jason Blum. Seriously. I can't have Candyman this year. I can't have Halloween Kills this year. But it's okay to put out crap like The Craft Legacy, which I can't tell if it's a sequel, a reboot, or a remake. You can do better, Jason. Please. You wonder why I spend a lot of time on Jason Blum and Blumhouse Pictures. It's because they put out crap. And the only time they really put something good out, if you have a name attached to as director. Because this film is not going to succeed on VOD. I can tell you that right now. I would not be surprised if this film makes less than Bill and Ted Face the Music on VOD. Because that film made at least $30 million that we know of on VOD. I don't think The Craft Legacy is going to make close to that. I could be wrong, but for a $20 rental price tag. I'm skipping this one. Every day, there's a family struggling with hospital bills to care for their sick child, who is fighting an illness. There's a woman who is fighting breast cancer and is having trouble making ends meet while paying for their treatment. And there are burn victims that are going through treatments to heal their deep wounds. There is a charity in the horror community that helps these people. Scares That Care is an organization that helps families deal with the bills for their child. They help women get the treatment they need to fight breast cancer, and they help people who are dealing with severe burns get the help they need to heal. Scares That Care is a 100% volunteer organization and 501c3 nonprofit charity that is dedicated to helping these people in fighting real monsters. To find out more information or to donate to Scares That Care, you can go to www.scaresthatcare.org. Every donation helps Scares That Care fight real monsters.
Hey guys, this is Steven Christina. I'm the founder, owner, creator, and host of Super Retro Throwback Reviews. Are you looking for the best movie reviews, music reviews, video game reviews, and Comic-Con coverage all around? Well then look no further. Definitely check out Super Retro Throwback Reviews on YouTube and our new audio podcast, the new and improved Super Retro Throwback Reviews Audio Files version 2.0 on the following media distributors: Podbean, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, and Spotify.
Class is over, John! Time for something new and improved!
Welcome back to Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm here with author Patrick Rahal. You may know him because he's already been on the podcast earlier this year, along with Ashes of Our Nightmare. You know him mostly as Patsy the Angry Nerd from Throwdown Thursday and Shock Bites. He is here today to talk about his debut book, How Much Do You Tip an Exorcist? How are you doing today, Patrick?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you so much for wanting to talk about the book. I really appreciate it.
Now, before we get to everything, since you're a podcaster, I'm a podcaster, and last segment on my podcast, I talked about The Craft Legacy trailer, which ended up like one of my long-winded rants, which we're not going to hear about anymore from me. What are your thoughts on the trailer?
Well, I enjoyed the original, but it seems to me that what Blumhouse has done with their last couple of big trailers like this and Black Christmas, where they're remaking, you know, beloved properties, is they give away the entire movie in the trailer, and so there's no reason to see the movie. Like in Black Christmas, I was like, oh, well, that's a twist. Oh, I didn't know that was going to happen. Oh, okay, well, that's fun. And you revealed who the bad guy was. Okay, I don't need to see this movie. And then watching this trailer, it seemed like whoever the director was, I don't think she had any say in what the trailer was, because the original film, it was basically, and I'm blanking on her name, but like the one girl against the other three, and she was good and they were all bad. And now this trailer is absolutely 100% she's bad and she's more powerful and the other three have to band together to defeat her. That's absolutely what's going on. And just throwing in a picture of Firouza Balk and, you know, her catchphrase there, you know, "We are the weirdos, mister," isn't enough for me. It's not. Like, I didn't get the Craft vibes from this. I got, you know, any of those, like, you know, Carrie or any of those movies with kids with psychokinetic powers. That's what I got out of this. Like, I didn't see magic or anything. I mean, obviously, like, the little things are like, oh, look, we did your makeup. Oh, look, we did this. It seemed more to me like people with superhero powers. It's like they turned it into a superhero film more than a film about girls battling through witchcraft. I don't know what you thought, but I
I mean, tell you, I really felt sad for David Duchovny and Michelle Moynihan being attached to this film.
Yeah, I don't think... I mean, I think they're definitely going to be bright spots in this. And I don't want to cast any aspersions on the actresses who were playing the four teens there, because they seemed like they're really into it, and you know, from what I saw in the trailer, they seem to be doing a decent job. It's not their fault that the script is so heavy-handed and just like, again, why would you give away everything in the trailer? Like, I hate that. Like, leave some intrigue.
I know, it's been the typical Blumhouse formula lately with these remakes and sequels. Yeah. I even said in my rant, I think, or might have said in my rant, that Jason Blum is trying to ruin every horror film ever made.
You think it's like a long con where he's like this huge guy in horror, but he actually hates horror, and so he's trying to ruin it?
I don't think he hates horror. I just think he doesn't put the right people in. It's like, unless it was like David Gordon Green or Leigh Whannell, it always turns out badly in the trailer that you don't want to see the film.
And see, here's the thing that kind of bugged me, and it went with a couple other films. Like, I didn't see Black Christmas because I didn't have to, because I saw the trailer. I did recently watch Fantasy Island. And the problem is, you get these really strong actors, you know, Maggie Q, Michael Pena, and I forget who the young lady was. I want to call her like Haley something.
Lizzie Hale, I think?
Lizzie Hale, that's, yeah. I was close. I got Haley out of Lizzie. but Lucy Hale.
Lucy Hale, yes.
Lizzie Hale is Hailstorm.
I was thinking Hailstorm. I don't know why I said that.
No, it's close. See, we both were like right there on the cusp of it. You get strong performances from your crew, like your actors, but to come up, like I'm curious to know how much he is involved with the storylines and how much he's involved with cutting these trailers, because like Fantasy Island definitely didn't give away the plot, but like, I don't know if you saw it, but I watch it and I was like, oh yeah, I remember this season of Lost. Like, what the fuck? Like, this is awful. Where's the smoke monster?
I have not seen Fantasy Island yet.
It's like Lost meets Moana.
Because I watched, I think, the remake with Malcolm McDowell. Love that one.
Okay.
And it's like, because I know that remake was a television series. That was actually good. This one looks like it sucks. So I haven't had time to see it yet.
Again, it's got very strong performances from all the actors involved. Even the guy that starred with Michael Pena and Chips, Dax Shepard, that's who it was. Even he got a decent performance, you know, and I was fairly impressed with how he did. He was good in that. But yeah, it was weird, and I wasn't a huge fan. But as far as the craft goes, I mean, again, I'm all for remakes. One of my favorite movies of all time technically is a remake, you know, The Thing, 1982. But, you know, you and I think are of a similar mind, where we much prefer the independent creators to, you know, the bigger budgeted Hollywood endeavors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some good Hollywood directors, like Lynette Winnell, James Wan.
From Saw. Oh, those guys.
David Gordon Green.
Refresh me, who he is and what he's done?
David Gordon Green?
Yeah.
He did a lot of Halloween.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I knew the name, I just could not remember.
And I believe you also did Pineapple Express 2.
That I didn't know there was a sequel, and I haven't seen the original.
No, there's a, no, Pineapple Express is actually a standalone film. And Halloween is like the reboot that he did a couple years ago.
Oh, you were saying Pineapple Express also. Sorry, I thought
no,
you
meant... it was just Seth Rogen, James Franco.
Yeah, no, I knew it. I thought you meant like that he had done a sequel to that. Like, oh, I didn't know there was. It's just the way you said it. I took it as.
I was trying to say another film he did.
In addition to. No, I get you now. I was like, oh, man, I've also been drinking rum for the past 3 hours. So, because I just got off a live podcast with my brothers and my wife talking sports. So I didn't quite get where you were going with that one. So, yeah, sorry, that's my fault. Now that I listen back to what you're saying, yes, you articulated it correctly. I just heard it wrong.
Let's get on with the interview.
Yeah, let's do that.
Now, I know you mostly as a podcaster. How did you get into podcasting?
Getting into podcasting, it's a funny story. I have several friends who kind of inspired me. And it's funny, there's like a long line of folks who inspired them. And I kind of want to shout those guys out. So it started, I guess, with Outside the Cinema with Bill Fulkerson. And if you haven't, yeah, I know you're a big indie.
Survival of the Film Freaks.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Great film available on Amazon to stream. They kind of inspired Trick or Treat Radio. And Trick or Treat Radio, they're all friends of mine. You know, actually, Johnny Wolfenstein, when we first started doing this podcast, was our producer. They invited me on. One day, and it was my first ever podcast. It was Trick or Treat Radio, episode number 68. All the boys love Larry Fine. That was the name, and I had so much fun. And that was like December of 2013. And a few years later, I was thinking about it. I was like, I kind of want to start my own show. Like, I want to do my own show. Like, it's fun listening to shows, and you know, when you're at home and you're listening, and I'm sure you've done this, and I'm sure your listeners are the same way, like, you'll express an opinion, and, like, maybe you feel very strongly about a certain thing, like, say, about Blumhouse films, and somebody might vehemently disagree with you, and, like, they're yelling into their, just into the ether, because you can't hear them, because it's a recording. And it's like, oh, you know what, I think I want to start talking about my own thing. And my original show idea was I started doing this thing called Throwdown Thursday to kind of piggyback off the Throwback Thursday hashtag that was trending at the time. And I'm like, what if we took random characters and we had them face off against each other? You know, similar to like what Death Battle did, but instead of like doing all the research into physics and whatnot, we just had people vote. And that kind of built into what I was doing. And when I first did the first couple of episodes, it was with my friend, Agent Nicole, who is no longer on the show. She did about 100 episodes with us, and it didn't work out. I didn't think it through as well as I would have liked, because we also would record 2 episodes every other Saturday. So it was kind of a weird thing, because you couldn't have people vote on something if you were recording every other Saturday. So it's like, oh, this show aired, you know, on the 10th, and this show airs on the 17th. But they were both recorded prior to that, so you can't take any feedback for those shows because they're already recorded. Then Johnny Wolfenstein ended up moving to Maryland, and so we took over doing our own show. I learned how to, you know, produce the show, and we got all our own equipment. And that was June, July of 2019, and now we've been going strong ever since. My wife Ash has joined on like the 3rd episode she came on, and she was like, wow, this is a lot of fun. And I was like, see, I told you. And now we're about to drop. We're in the 220s at this point.
What made you want to step out of the podcasting and dive into the literary field?
Well, I've always enjoyed expressing myself creatively, whether it be like drawings or, you know, like little stories. Like, I've been writing ever since I was a little kid. And around the time I was 12 or so around 6th grade, which would be 1993, I got really frustrated, and I was like, no one's going to read this stuff. Like, it's too crazy. It's too off the wall. Like, it's too dumb. No one's going to ever read this. So I'm just going to stick to reading instead of writing. I would read a lot of Stephen King, and I read a story called The Mangler, which is about a haunted laundry machine that kills people. And I was like, all right, well, nothing I write is going to be stupid in comparison. And they made The Mangler into a movie, and it has a sequel. So I was like, all right, nothing I could possibly write is going to be dumber than a haunted laundry machine that kills people. Now, as a premise, that's stupid, and I'm very much oversimplifying it, but there's, you know, really good detail that goes into it, you know, as Stephen King does, you know, all about the whole, you know, like the specific herbs, like belladonna gets, you know, mixed in with some laundry, and like that gets exposed into the thing, and then, you know, a young girl cuts herself, and now they've got the blood of a virgin, and like you mix this with this with this with this with this, and it creates sentience in this laundry machine. So there was, you know, there was some, you know, actual research that went into it. I'm very much oversimplifying it, but I read all kinds of stories. Like, I read a lot of Norse mythology that I really enjoyed, Egyptian mythology, Greek and Roman, which is essentially the same thing. You just switch the names around. I enjoyed reading a lot, so I wanted to tell my own stories.
How did you come up with the title of the book that we're going to talk about? How much do you tip an exorcist? And what made you want to have an offbeat title for this collection?
Well, the title came about because I was just talking with some people one day. It might have even been at work. And I was like, how come when you drive through at Dunkin's, you leave them a tip, but when you drive through at, like, McDonald's, you don't leave a tip? And then we started talking about other professions that would leave a tip, you know, and, like, well, how come you don't tip firefighters, you know, but you tip, like, the pizza guy, you know, like, arguably the firefighter is doing a more important job. And then it just delved into, you know, it devolved into, like, crazy stuff. It was a weird thing, but once I came up with that title, I was like, oh my god, that's going to be the title. And as you know, because you've gone through some of the horror haikus that are in it, that's kind of the subject of one of those horror haikus.
What was it like writing this book compared to all the podcasting you do?
Podcasting, you don't have to worry, at least I don't. I don't worry about editing myself. Like, most of what you see, or if we do a live show, see or hear, is just off the cuff. With, you know, if I don't articulate an idea particularly well, I just be like, well, you know what I mean. If you're writing, it's different because you have to really draw your audience in and make them care about what you're talking about. With the podcast, sometimes, you know, people are going to come in with a preconceived notion. It's like, well, I don't really care about, you know, Godzilla, so I'm not going to listen to that episode. But I really like Doctor Strange, so I want to listen to their take on that. So, with the book, when you're writing a story, you want to tell a complete narrative, but also keep your reader's attention until you get, you know, to the end of the story. And hopefully that when folks read this, they'll get to the end of each story or each haiku or each two-sentence story, and they'll say, okay, that was a complete narrative. I liked parts A, B, and C, and yeah, I feel satisfied with the end of that.
This book has four sections. Two-word sentences, horror haikus, short stories, and fake lists, including a list that the people at Sci-Fi are already reading as they are looking to make their next annoying Sharknado-type franchise for me to rant about.
Oh, I hope they do.
What gave you the idea to have separate sections instead of doing a traditional short story collection?
So, a lot of this has to do with Jeanette Andromeda, who is the illustrator of this book, and a beyond phenomenal artist. She's... we did this thing back in 2015 called Horror Haikus Day. We had met at Rock and Shock and became friends, and we've been close friends since then. We were doing this thing called Horror Haikus Day, where I would come up with a haiku and she would illustrate it. And then I would see how great her art was. And she would post it on social media, you know, for her Horror Maid was the title it was going underneath. And, you know, I would see her artwork, and I was like, man, I have to step up my story game. But at the same time, she would, and she's told me this, I'm not, you know, speaking out of school when I say this, she said that, you know, my stories would make her push her art to another level. And so we both kept kind of pushing each other without realizing we were doing it. The two sentence stories kind of goes back to a thread on Reddit where folks, and I ended up seeing it on Facebook, and I did a bunch of them because I like to write, and, you know, trying to come up with a complete narrative with two sentences is difficult. But there was a thread on Reddit talking about the scariest two sentence stories. And I think the one that ended up winning, I mean, I don't know if there was like an actual contest, but the one that everyone kind of agreed was the scariest was the last man on earth sat alone in his house and there was a knock on the door. And it's, you know, I tried to capture that a little bit. I think my favorite one, I mean, I know my favorite one is called The Muddy Boots. And I think it's, I mean, I don't know if it's on par with that. That's up for you, up for, you know, the reader to decide. But it says, I really hate when my husband leaves his muddy boots in the hallway. I don't mean to nag, but he was buried in them. Like, I just really liked that. And then I had a bunch of short stories. I had released a book of short stories called Monsters in the Closet that I self-published. I do have a couple other books that I self-published, but they are absolute garbage. Going back and looking at some of the stuff I've written 10, 12 years ago compared to what I've written now, it's absolute trash. And I think that's a testament to me attempting to get better. And, you know, I tend not to promote myself that much, but with this, I've gotten a lot of really positive feedback. So I've kind of been pushing it more and more because I think I can tell good stories. And, you know, with Monsters in the Closet, it was flash fiction. So it's 500 words or less. You have to tell an entire story. And it's difficult, but it's fun as a writer trying to challenge yourself where it's like, okay, I have unlimited space. I can just tell whatever story I want. I can write a 1,200-page novel. It doesn't matter. But when you really pigeonhole yourself and it's like, okay, you have 500 words, you know, you need a beginning, a middle, an end, a climax, a satisfying resolution. It's challenging, but it's a lot of fun. And I think the way this book is set up with all the different styles of writing, I think it really, it fits people with a busy lifestyle. So it's like, I don't have time to read, you know, this long novel. I mean, because it's about 150 pages, but there's, you know, the horror haikus, the two sentence stories, the lists, you know, in each of those stories, I think the longest story might be like 10 pages, if that, but, you know, it's a lot of fun and I wanted to kind of mix things up. You know, if you're looking at a book that's the title is How Much Do You Tip an Exorcist, it can't be a standard cookie cutter, you know, book that you're going to pick up from anybody, you know?
What drew you to the two sentence stories?
That, like I was saying, is, you know, like the Reddit thread about the, you know, the last man on earth. And I think part of it had to do with, can I tell a complete story with just two sentences? And I really got sucked into it. There's a whole bunch that didn't make it into this book that, you know, maybe will be in another collection down the road. But there's a whole bunch that didn't make it into this. But I think it's, for me, it was the challenge of telling a complete story in only two sentences. Like, you're not using every tool at your disposal, you know, to explain what's going on and paint a word picture. But at the same time, you're using every weapon in your arsenal in order to complete this story in just two sentences.
You also have a section after that called Horror Hakus. What made you want to focus on the Japanese style of poems compared to traditional poems?
Well, I mean, I guess that, you know, all depends on what your definition of traditional poems. I mean, are we looking at sonnets and, you know, with rhyming couplets like Shakespeare did, you know, quatrains, you know, there's all kinds of different stuff. But I think with haikus, where you have the five syllables, the seven syllables, and the five syllables, you know, each line, the three lines comprising of a total of 17 syllables, that again is another one of those things is like, can I tell an entire story with just 17 syllables. You know, it's kind of like the two-sentence stories. Can I tell a whole story in just two sentences? It was a lot of fun. It was challenging. You know, going back and forth. It's like, oh, I like this word better. And it's like, you know, I can't use that word because now the sentence structure doesn't make sense. You know, like, that was kind of difficult, but again, it was a lot of fun. And then getting to see the illustrations that Jeanette did to go along with some of these, like, she did all new illustrations for this book. She kind of took a couple of, you know, like, she kind of took the bones of stuff that she had done before. And like I was saying with, like, my stuff that was garbage back, you know, 10, 12 years ago, her artwork was amazing back then in 2015 when she was doing this. It's phenomenal now. Like, if you consider phenomenal above amazing, like, she did such a great job. She has improved greatly. If you were able to see some of the stuff that she has done before, and then to take the same things and, you know, turn them into, you know, make just grayscale drawings. She was even nice enough to put myself and Ashes into two of the drawings. If you look under the haiku costume and the haiku Daylight, she definitely drew that character as my wife Ashes. And costume is 100% me, down to the fact that he's got a patch on his vest that says Patsy on it, which I didn't notice when she originally did it. But I was like, oh, man, she put me in the thing. Like, that's so cool. But yeah, for me, I think it was more the challenge than anything else.
What was it like working with Jeanette Andromeda on the book in trying to get your vision to how the artwork should look?
I trust Jeanette with my work because she is such a talented artist. If you've ever seen my podcast logo or any of the other shirts that we've done, you know, like the Von Nightmare Vineyards shirt where it's a bunch of grapes, but it's all the grapes are different skulls, or my Patsy logo where it's kind of like the Jaws thing, but it's me coming up underneath a shark. I trusted her to take whatever I had done and, you know, apply her unique vision to it, because there were a couple of things I was like, okay, this is what I would do. And then what she came up with, I was like, oh, yeah, this is way better. This is way better than I even imagined. Like, I can't draw at the same level as Jeanette. Like, I can occasionally get something good to come out, but Jeanette is just light years ahead of me. And everyone's going to interpret things differently, and, like, the way I was looking at a couple of things. Like, there were a couple I had no clue what to do, like, you know, for the haiku gratuity, where I got the name of the book from, I had no clue how I was going to do that. And she took it and ran with it. And I was like, you know what, whatever she wants to do, that's how it's going to be. I mean, obviously she, you know, she would say, hey, this is what I've got. Do you like it? And there, I don't think I rejected a single thing, because I was like, this is just absolutely fantastic. And there's nothing I'm going to say that's going to improve or change this. Like, she is beyond talented, and I'm very lucky to have her as an illustrator.
I noticed that this artwork in both the two-sentence stories and horror haikus that fit each story in those sections, but when it came to the short stories, you only get the artwork between the title of each story. Why did you decide to scale back on the artwork in the short story sections to only the designs to the title cards?
Well, part of that was, I mean, I wasn't even expecting the story header art that she did. That was something that she did on her own. She did not do these illustrations for free. She and I negotiated what she called a fair deal. I think I should have paid her quadruple. But I just simply did not have that much money. She earned every cent, and then to come up with 10 extra drawings. There's a total of 40 drawings when you count those story headers. Although she has said in interviews that she next time she wants to illustrate the stories as well. But we also have agreed on compensation for whatever book sales. I'm going to give her a percentage of what I make, because what she did and what I paid her for, she was grossly underpaid, and I wish I had more money to give to her. And, you know, obviously I'm going to, as soon as I get royalty checks, like, I'm going to give her money. And yeah, just seeing this art, like I said, with the horror haikus and the two-sentence stories, like, we talked about that a little bit, where we did the horror haikus day thing, and then it kind of evolved into the two-sentence Tuesday. So she had already done a lot of these drawings. There's one that she did in there that she definitely had to redo, the one for Cheat Meal, because there was a specific politician whose head was on the grill, and she thought that might not be politically correct, although it might be something that all of us might be thinking. It might not be as politically correct to show a decapitated politician with their head on a grill in a story about cannibalism. So she changed that a little bit. But she had already had, like I said, like the bones of what she wanted to do, and she redid them with her increased skill and her, in grayscale as opposed to color for social media. And I think she did an absolutely amazing job.
Each of the stories is around 5 to 10 pages. What made you want to keep the stories to that length?
Well, I think with these types of stories, several of them, so I have created in my head and in some published works what I call the Riftverse, which is an alternate version of Earth where there was an interdimensional rift and giant monsters of the Lovecraft variety have invaded, and this burst of energy came out, and it subsequently changed humans into like different categories. Like some were given enhanced powers, others were given, you know, just driven mad, similar to the rage infected. You know, they're not zombies, but the rage infected people of 28 days and weeks later. Other people just became absolutely terrible, and like all their worst inclinations kind of manifest to the forefront, in addition to all these giant monsters that came everywhere. So I kind of was telling different stories from that universe, and they didn't need to be overly long because they were going to be part of a larger narrative, like several of the stories. Too Ugly for Heaven, Tiny White Will Punch Your Fucking Lights Out. I always get this one wrong because I say it in the wrong order. The Twisted Tragic Tale of Michael Ravenshadow, Roboctopus, Croctopus, and The Girl on the Train. Those all kind of take place in the same universe, like, and they're all different perspectives on different people when the rift happened. I have a couple other stories, one that was in last year's More Lore from the Mythos anthology that came out in November of last year, called The Shed, which is Lovecraftian body horror. And I have another story in Volume 2, which comes out on October 17th, called Scavengers. And then I have another story that takes place in that universe coming out in another anthology that drops on Halloween called VHS Nightmares. So what I'm kind of doing is telling different stories from different parts of the world, you know, from different points of view of different people. And it doesn't need to be a long narrative. Like, a lot of these are self-contained, you know, and you'll never see them again. Others, I kind of consider them origin stories, because I think, you know, the Raven Shadow story and the Too Ugly for Heaven and the Tiny White story, those are all going to be, those characters are going to be expanded upon at some point. And those folks, speaking of Trick or Treat Radio, those are all characters inspired, or named after, I should say. They're not inspired by, because, you know, Raven Shadow is not a raving lunatic, and, you know, Dynamo doesn't, you know, run around killing people, and Tiny White is not, you know, the owner of a countrywide chain of restaurants. But I just wanted to name these characters after those guys, kind of immortalize them, because they were so cool to me, and like we've become friends over the past, you know, 7 years. But yeah, I just thought their characters were cool, and, you know, name somebody after them. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying.
Yes. One of my favorite stories in the book is called The Librarian versus the Controller. How did you come up with that story?
I am a fan of riddles. So, you know, Bilbo versus Gollum. That was a fun section of The Hobbit. Also, for folks who are familiar with Stephen King's Dark Tower series. The riddle contest with Blaine the Mono in Wizarding Glass, that one had a huge impact on me, partly because I read The Wastelands, and it ends with, "Let the contest begin." And I was fortunate enough not to read these as they came out, because I would have had to wait 8 years to see the beginning of this contest. But I had, unknown to me, purchased Wizarding Glass at a yard sale many, many years before. So as soon as I finished that, and I was like, oh my God, I need to know what happens next. I was like, oh shit, I have this book somewhere. And I tore apart my room looking for these books, and I found it. And I was able to read through the entire riddle contest. And the flaw in, you know, so many different, you know, computer stories, you know, when there's a higher intelligence, is if you contradict its programming and force it to, you know, make different decisions than it would normally make, and, you know, kind of screw up its logic center. There's an episode of Futurama about that with Robot Santa. like, I put all those things together, and one of the, like, the main thrust of the joke, or the logic problem, was a thing I had read about an explorer who got captured by cannibals, and they would allow him to make one statement, and based on the statement, they would determine in which manner he would die. And so he made a statement, and he was allowed to leave because he thwarted their logic. And I was like, okay, how can I tell that story? I'll be honest with you, that's my least favorite of the stories that I've written in that book. It could have been fleshed out way more.
What made you want to use all caps for the controller's dialogue in that story?
To really illustrate, I should have put it in italics too, but to really illustrate, you know, how loud, because, you know, you have this young woman, Lena, which is short for Evangelina. I never say that, but it's short for Evangelina. She is standing in the middle of this room, and there is sound coming from everywhere, and it just... It's another way of the controller, who is this, you know, sentient Skynet-like big brother type of AI system that has taken over the world. It's just another way to intimidate or show their superiority by completely dwarfing, you know, the whoever happens to be talking to the controller at the time, you know, just bombarding them with sound.
Finally, you end your book with a couple of lists. Angry superpowers and awesome ideas that the Sci-Fi Channel should totally turn into films. What made you come up with the idea to include lists in this book?
Well, I had made one of these lists on like a Facebook post or something a while ago, and some people were coming up with some, like, really interesting powers, so I was trying to come up with some fun ones too. And then, so I was like, well, I'm gonna take the ones that I did and just keep them. You know, maybe some point I'll use them. The awesome ideas that sci-fi should totally turn into films. I think that these would be fun asylum films, and, you know, like, they're not out of the realm of possibility. Like, I could see a way of doing each and every one of these in a way where, you know, the characters involved could at least take them seriously. I mean, if they're ever looking for an idea, you know, I've got lots of them. And I work cheap, so.
I have an idea what Sci-Fi Channel should do.
What's that?
I'll make that pitch right now. 5 hardcore horror fans are kidnapped by a mysterious movie producer who forces them to watch some of the worst remakes of all time. And they find out, as these films continue to go on, that the person that kidnapped them is none other than Jason Blum! I had to get that out there.
That sounds too real.
Yeah. Because I just think sometimes he just does stuff to insult hardcore horror fans' intelligence.
Yeah, like I said, you know, it almost seems like he's trying to bring it down from the inside. Well, I have a question for you, Mr. Anthony T.
Yes.
And you said you have the book handy.
Yes.
So what I would like you to do is I would like you to open the book and to the first page that says itemized invoice on it.
Yes.
And see if you can check out the cool Easter eggs that I put into that invoice. If you take a look at some of the things, see how much you pick up on. Because this itemized invoice is specifically dedicated to the hardcore horror fan.
Ah, okay. Exorcism, 24 hours. It's going to be an The Exorcist connection to one of these things. Can't figure it out because I've never seen that film.
Oh, you've never. All right, so I didn't know you've never seen it. So I'm gonna kind of go through and I'm gonna walk you through what these are, okay? So the invoice date and the invoice number, 12/26 in 1973. That is the day that The Exorcist appeared in theaters.
Okay.
The bill from Karras and Marin. Those are the two priests. Bill to Chris McNeil, and that's the address that they had in the movie. And so I went and I checked what the tax rate is for that address, and it's 8.25%.
Wow.
So 8.25% on a subtotal of $615.24. Do you want to take a guess as to what that comes out to?
A lot of money.
$666.
Uh-oh.
And then you'll notice that the tip section is blank, but...
What can you do?
So, I let everyone make their own choice as to how much you would tip an Exorcist.
I've seen The Exorcist 3, but that's about it.
Is that the one with Patrick Ewing as the Angel of Death?
Oh, yes. I saw that on the last drive-in. That was like the worst week out of season 2.
I've seen all of them. I think there's the 5 total, because there's 2 prequels.
That's like the only Exorcist film I've ever seen. I have the original Exorcist at home. It's just I never get time to see that film.
I think you should make time to see that one because it's a classic and it's terrifying. I read the book, and you know what's crazy is the guy who wrote the book, William Peter Blatty, wrote it because he had been working in Hollywood and he was typecast because he kept writing scripts for Pink Panther movies. And they were like, oh, he just writes comedy. And he's like, I'll show you guys. And then he wrote The Exorcist. It's like, well, way to break out of that box there, Chief. It's definitely stepping outside your comfort zone.
Yeah. Let's get back on track.
Sorry.
Not a problem. The book is being released by Source Point Press.
Yes.
How did that deal come about? Because they're usually known for comics and graphic novels.
So, at Scarecon last year, where you and I met for the first time, during the podcast awards, we had a booth right near comic writer Ben Goldsmith. And Ben ended up joining us on our show. He's got a huge personality, very talented writer, super funny, just like awesome to be around. Like you can't be in a bad mood around this guy. He's just awesome. We ran into him at Terrificon at Mohegan Sun later that year, and we were talking. It was his birthday too. He gave us some cake, and I was talking about, oh yeah, you know, I put a book out a while ago. You know, I never talk about it. You know, I probably should. And he's like, oh, I didn't know you were a writer. We have a prose section at Source Point, and we're always looking for stuff. You know, like it would have to be at least 150 pages. And I'm like, well, I've got this thing that I've been working on. I call it, you know, how much do you tip an exorcist? And he's like, oh my god, that title. I love that title. He's like, oh, are you going to be at Boston Fan Expo? And I was like, no, we're not, you know, we're not going to make it to that one. And he's like, well, what about Rock and Shock? I'm like, yeah, we don't miss Rock and Shock. Like, we'll be there. And he's like, all right, well, this guy Josh is going to be there. And Josh is like, you know, the head guy in charge who you know, decides what we're going to publish and what we're not. So, you know, get something together and, you know, make a pitch to him. So I had never made a book pitch before. I had no idea. Like, everything that I had done was, like, self-published. I mean, my first two books, Cycle of the Hunter and Mist and Shadow, it's essentially you know, it was a publishing company that were like, yeah, just send us your book. We'll, you know, we'll publish it. We don't care. Whatever. Like, they didn't do any marketing or anything. And then when the books didn't sell, they're like, yeah, your $20 book from some guy no one ever heard of isn't selling, so we're going to start charging $25 and $30 for it. I'm like, yeah, that'll help. You know, you can get a Stephen King book for $7.99, but yeah, someone's going to pay $30 for my book. Okay. So I, again, not knowing what to do or how to do it, I polished everything up, put everything together as, you know, as best as I could. And then I printed it out on regular printer paper and had like 300 sheets of paper that I gave this guy in like a little binder. And I was like, here's my book. It weighed like 12 pounds. And I'm like, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm like, I've never done this, but like, Ben told me to talk to you, so I'm talking to you. This is my book. And he's like, well, what do you call it? And I'm like, how much do you tip an exorcist? And he's like, I could sell it on that title alone. And so he loved the drawings that Jeanette did. He likes it. He was like reading through some of the stuff. He's like, this is excellent. He goes, I love this. Like, he's like, I have so many things going through my head right now. Yeah, let's do it. We'll do it. So that's how it happened, you know, because, we made friends with Ben. Ben pointed us in the right direction. And, you know, that's, the rest, as they say, is history. And Ben was nice enough to purchase my book and, you know, promote it. So I appreciate everything that he's done for me as well, and I make sure I give him credit every time because, you know, I'll be honest, without Ben and without Jeanette, it doesn't matter how good what I've written is. Jeanette's artwork takes it to a whole other level. Like, you see the artwork and you want to see what's written below. Like, what does this have to do with this? Oh my God, this artwork is amazing. I've had two different people, independent of each other, say, I want this tattoo. For the story, Refusal, both my wife and, my friend Alyssa both want that tattooed because, her art is that good.
Any other future projects that you have on the horizon writing wise?
Well, I touched on a couple of things, really briefly earlier. I have, a story called Scavengers that's coming out on, the 17th of October, which happens to be Ashes von Nightmare's birthday. It's called More Lore from the Mythos 2. It's a Lovecraft collection. It's an anthology, and I'm in there. There are some amazing writers in there, Steve Van Samson and Trisha Woldridge, who are phenomenal. Steve was in the first volume of that, More Lore Volume 1, with me as well. And Steve and I are actually in another anthology that comes out on Halloween called VHS Nightmares. It's a story. It's basically an anthology of a bunch of people who are just like, you know, whether it's, you know, a late night trip to the local video store or, you know, something that you rented that wasn't quite what you thought it was going to be. That's kind of where mine goes. Mine's about three young girls that, you know, they're in high school. It takes place in like 1991. So they're in high school and they rent a bunch of movies. And one of them is called Lesbian Cannibal Chainsaw Quinceañera 3, The Choppening. Just love that title. And I've had people tell me, like, I would watch that movie. And I'm like, yeah, I would too. Like, but they all watch a movie and, like, some crazy shit happens with the tape and they don't know what to do about it. And it's pretty brutal. It's pretty brutal. But I've got that. I'm working on actually turning a couple of scripts into movies. Scripts that I've written into short stories and vice versa. I actually do have something that I'm working on that I'm trying to expand a little bit and actually pitch as a movie script. So fingers crossed on that one. But yeah, I'm just going to keep writing. I mean, I write different articles for my website, throwitonthursdaypodcast.com. I just did a review of Anonymous Killers, the movie that dropped on October 6th. I do a women in horror section on that. I write for womeninhorror.net. I write sports articles. You know, there's all kinds of stuff. You know, it's, you know, like you were saying earlier, off air, like how busy we all get. Like, I do Throwdown Thursday and I do, Shark Bites and I do the Loudest Sports Show and I do Indie Creator Spotlight and I work full time and I'm trying to watch movies and write and, you know, and once in a while see my wife. So that's the goal.
Where can they find you on social media?
You can find me at the aforementioned ThrowdownThursdayPodcast.com. But you can follow me on Twitter at Patrick Rahal. On Instagram, same thing. You can follow the show on Twitter at TD Thursday Pod. Throwdown Thursday Podcast on Instagram. I'm on Facebook under PJ Rahal. And I think that's about it for social media.
Patrick, I want to thank you for coming on to my podcast again.
Oh, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me about my book and help spread awareness of it. And thank you very much for purchasing it. And I will come on your show anytime because I love chatting with you. I think you're a phenomenal human being, and I always enjoy your thoughts on horror.
Thank you very much. Have a good day and stay safe.
Thank you. You too.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
This is Carrie.
This is Billy.
This is Mr. Bo.
And we are from A Podcast from Beneath. You can catch us every Wednesday wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Don't forget, you can find Anthony T's Horror Show on social media, over on Facebook, Instagram, and Slasher app at Anthony T's Horror Show, on Twitter at Anthony T's Horror. If you liked this episode, you can subscribe to Anthony T's Horror Show over on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. You can also catch Anthony T's Horror Show over on DocDiscussions.com, where you can find my podcast and other podcasts on the Doc Discussions Network. What's Anthony T watching? Well, I've been doing the 31 Days of Halloween over on Anthony T's Horror Show on Facebook. I'll explain more on what that is at the close of this podcast. But most recently, one of the films that I saw during the 31 Days of Halloween is The Craft. And yes, since I mentioned and talked about The Craft legacy during this episode, I really felt the need to watch The Craft and remind myself that this is a very good film that didn't need a sequel or whatever you call the film, because I'm still confused if it's a sequel, reboot, or remake. But anyway, enough with The Craft legacy. I'm done talking about it this episode. Now, The Craft was a film directed by Andrew Fleming, who also directed the very good horror film and definitely underrated horror film Bad Dreams in 1988, which starred Bruce Abbott, Jennifer Rubin, and Richard Lynch. If you can find this film, I highly recommend you go out of your way to see this film. It's a very good and very underrated horror film. But we're going to talk about his other horror film in his filmography, because Andrew Fleming, to my knowledge, has only done two horror films: Bad Dreams, which I just mentioned, and the film I'm talking about, The Craft. This is definitely a very good film. It's definitely a classic horror film. This is a film that has not lost its luster over the years. I still think it's a very good horror film to this day. One of the main reasons why I think this film is still very good to this day is the screenplay of this film. The screenplay in which Andrew Fleming and co-writer Peter Filadi, if I pronounce it wrong, I apologize, does a very good job in the way it really created the characters for this film, as they tend to be kind of relatable as outcasts and everything. But what really, I think, goes beyond the fact that the characters are relatable is the fact that this film has a very good screenplay. It really does a very good job focusing on the characters. It does a very good job making sure the action is timed very well. And it does a very good job moving the story along, as this film is one of those films where the story never has a dull moment. Andrew Fleming also does a great job with the direction in this film. Make no mistake about this film. Whether it's the way they direct his cast, or making sure that this film has a completely dark tone, whether it's in the direction or the screenplay he co-wrote, it really stays on point, doesn't go all over the place, which sometimes these horror films can with tone. But this one is a very dark film from start to finish. He also does a very good job in the way he directs his cast in this film. As I really thought, the four actresses in this film were very good in this. I like how Fairuza Balk, Robin Tunney, Neve Campbell, and Rachel True do a very good job in making sure that the four of them had very good chemistry with each other. Because that was, I think, one of the most important things that what I think made this film work so well, as each of the actresses really turned in good performances. Plus, they also worked well with each other, as they really had good chemistry with one another, which really made the whole friendship aspect of the four work so well. This is definitely a very good horror film that people should really check out. It also helped that this film had a very good soundtrack as well, as it had music from 90s artists such as Our Lady Peace, Sponge, and Jewel. It really gave me a great reminder of how the 90s were great music-wise, alongside film-wise. But definitely, The Craft is definitely a very good film. If you have not seen this film, I highly recommend you check this film out. This is a really one of the great horror films to come out of the 90s. It also has a very good soundtrack that really pretty much defines the 90s music-wise. Sure, you had other grunge bands as well that defined that era of music, but The Craft soundtrack is another soundtrack that really defined what 90s music is for you music lovers. But I highly recommend you check The Craft out. It's a great film. There's a reason why this film today still holds up to when it was released back in 1996. As this has great acting, a very good story, and great direction from Andrew Fleming. I highly recommend you pick up the Scream Factory version of The Craft. And remember, we are the weirdos, mister. Couple of quick show notes. First, next episode will be a best of episode. In that episode, you will find past rants, including Jason Blum's takeover of episode 34, as yours truly went on an epic rant on the Black Christmas remake trailer. That's definitely a best of. In the segment afterwards, it's definitely a best of material too, because yours truly attempts to do an instructional video about the do's and don'ts in how to make a trailer. As Jason Blum's Black Christmas hijacked episode 34. I spent almost half an episode talking about a trailer. Well, I'm bringing both of those segments back on this edition of Best of Auntie T's Horror Show. Seriously, I could do a Best of Jason Blum Rants podcast episode, but I'm just only gonna do the Black Christmas trailer debacle, as that trailer really put people in the seats during Christmas time last year. Not by a long shot. That movie bombed miserably. You'll hear quite possibly why the film bombed, because literally, that trailer is the worst trailer in the history of movie trailers. That's on the next episode. Also on the next Best Of episode, I'll include a couple of Rock and Shock interviews from the past 2 years, as Rock and Shock's no more, but I figured why not air a couple of past interviews from that convention. So you'll get a couple of interviews, plus the epic 10-minute rant on Glenn Danzig's Veronica. For those who have not heard that rant, I will be re-airing that rant on the next Best Of episode, next episode. Also, yours truly was a guest on Shock Treatment with Mel and Maddie, as the three of us talked about guilty pleasure films and some of our favorite ones. That was definitely a fun time doing, and the episode is currently out right now. So hit up Shock Treatment with Mel and Maddie, which is available on the Dorkening Podcast Network. Definitely check out that show, which is available on major podcast providers. Over on Anthony T's Horror Show on Facebook, don't forget to like the page at facebook.com/AnthonyT's Horror Show. I am currently doing the 31 Days of Horror, and it goes like this. Sundays will be Scream Factory Sundays, meaning I'll watch a film and give you quick thoughts on what Scream Factory release I watched. Monday is Indie Monday, where I'll be watching an indie horror film. Tuesday is Italian Horror, meaning a film from Italy. You know, Dario Argento, Lucio Fulci, those kind of films. Wednesday will be Slasher Wednesday. You know what that means. Thursday will be 2020 Film Day, where I will watch a film released this year. Friday will be Arrow Friday, where I watch a film that is released by Arrow Video. And Saturday is Halloween Saturday, since Halloween this year falls on a Saturday. So I'll be watching a Halloween film and giving you my thoughts on a film that takes place on Halloween or is part of the story. Over on DocDiscussions.com, I have a new review column on the website called Reviews from the Horror Show. It's an extension of the podcast where I will write a review or two films. It's a column. My first column is my review of Darren Lynn Brosman's latest film, Death of Me, starring Maggie Chu and Luke Hemsworth. Definitely check that out over on DocDiscussions.com. With that, I want to thank you for listening to this edition of Anthony T's Horror Show. Have a good day, stay safe, and support indie horror.